Okay, another day, another live. How's everyone doing out there? Hope everyone is doing well. I hope the stream is a little better than yesterday on my end. I'm not sure if it's YouTube or if it's the fact that we have lockdowns here in Cyprus, which has very shaky internet to begin with. And when you have everyone at home or all the schools working via Zoom, then it just gets to the point of the internet just completely collapses. But let's hope that everything's a little better today. We'll see. We'll see how things go. But I hope everyone is doing well. Welcome back again. We always appreciate it when you are watching us and joining us for our live streams. And today we are going to discuss Brexit. Never-ending story of Brexit, if it will ever happen, and in what form it will happen. Valias, thank you very much, Valias, for that super chat. Appreciate it. We hope you're well. Hello to everyone in the UK. Moon Swan, Silverlight, hope you're doing well. Greetings to everyone in London, in Warsaw, Poland. Where else in London, UK again? And let's see, Marcus says that I recommend the Duran mugs, and they ain't paying me to say that. All right, no, we ain't. And you enjoy the mugs. Alexander's in Germany, too. Are you there, Alexander? Can you hear?
I am indeed, but you got a bit distorted, I'm afraid. So I lost some of what you said, I'm afraid. But
so you have a new shirt. You have a new shirt.
Oh, I do. I absolutely do. You can see it. This has got the flag of Korea, a country which I actually know very well because I have a relative, very close relative, who's married to a Korean woman. So I've been to Seoul and I've seen this beautiful country. Korea is a very beautiful country, very historic, very remarkable. And you can see that it has an extraordinary and very wonderful flag with the yin yang symbol and all sorts of things that you can see. And it's a glorious flag and it's a beautiful, amazing Duran shirt, long sleeved, which you absolutely need in this cold, dreary, wet, cold, dark London winter that we always have in December. So it keeps you beautifully warm in this kind of weather, but it's also stylish at all times of year. So, you know, best Duran shirts, the best shirts in the world, T-shirts, long-sleeved and short-sleeved, and you can find them in our shop. And I am the proud owner of yet another one.
All right. So I think my connection is crap. I was expecting it to be crap, to be honest. Mm-hmm. So we'll just, I think Alexander's connection is really, really good. I think the UK definitely has much better internet than we have here. Mm-hmm. And Alexander, so I'll just, it'll be Alexander anyway, and he'll be discussing Brexit. So Alexander, let's just get right on into it. And hopefully my connection gets better as we go along. But Alexander, what is the latest on Brexit? Will it ever happen? Will it ever happen? Alexander, go ahead.
Well, I think that's actually a very good question, because, of course, it's no longer a question of whether Britain will leave the formal political structures of the European Union, but how it leaves it. And that is absolutely crucial, because if it leaves the European Union, if it leaves its political structures, but is still locked in to its economic structures, then the logic of Brexit ultimately disappears. There was a very good article in the Times of London by a columnist, a well-known columnist here called Matthew Paris, former Conservative MP, somebody who used to be very close to Margaret Thatcher once upon a time, by the way. And he, by the way, is an arch Remainer, but he made the absolutely correct point that the only kind of Brexit that ultimately makes sense is a clean break Brexit. Now, I call it a clean break Brexit. Of course, many people here call it a no-deal Brexit, or they use even more catastrophic language, which I completely reject. I think that there is no basis or merit to using those terms. But it seems to me, unless you're prepared to go all the way and do that, and then perhaps as an entirely independent country, negotiate some kind of, you know, equitable free trade arrangement, whether be it on World Trade Organization terms or on some other terms, then unless you're prepared to do that, then there really isn't any point, because if you still remain in some form or other part of the European single market, subject to EU regulatory control, even if only on parts of your economy, but always on the most important parts, and if that regulatory control means that you remain subordinate through your legal system to the European Court of Justice, then what's the point of it? In fact, you're even worse position than you would have been if you'd remained within the European Union in the first place, because as a member of the European Union, you can have at least some kind of say, however notional, in the form these regulations take. But if you're outside the European Union, you have no role, no voice at all. So you are subordinating yourself to a regulatory structure over which ultimately you have no control at all. So the only kind of Brexit that makes sense to me, and as I said, Matthew Paris finally acknowledged the fact, is a Brexit which is a clean break, no deal Brexit, call it whatever you like, but that's the only Brexit that ultimately is a real one. And interestingly enough, he also acknowledged for the first time that if Britain didn't go for that sort of Brexit, not only would the issue remain unresolved, but sooner or later, the grievances, the sense of anger that there would be in the country would mean that, politically speaking, that question would resurface again. Now, I've just provided some of the background because this is essential to understanding the negotiations, if they are negotiations that are taking place, if they really are taking place at the moment. Now, when Boris Johnson won the election last year, and he won it almost exactly a year ago, got an 80-seat majority, said he would got that majority on the basis that he would get Brexit done. That was his slogan. He basically gave an assurance to the British people that he would get Brexit done this year. He said that he had an oven-ready deal, that it would all be sorted out this year, and that Britain would leave both the EU's political and its economic structures on the 31st of December 2020. And he also gave the impression that there would be some kind of free trade deal, basically on Australian lines or Canadian lines, negotiated with the EU, but it would be one in which Britain would be negotiating as a sovereign nation. And that was what he gave everybody the impression that he would do. And he took the further step of appearing to box himself in, which is, I think, done intentionally, by enacting all this into law. So, in theory, preventing an extension, a further extension, beyond the 31st of December. And we had negotiations, and those negotiations didn't seem to be going very far, because the European Union was making it very clear that they still wanted Britain to accept this regulatory structure over much of its industries. And there was an extraordinary battle, which we will go into in length, perhaps, over this programme, about fish and fishing quotas, and about who's entitled to fish in British waters, whether it's the British or whether it's the Europeans, and all sorts of things of that kind. So it didn't seem as if a deal was remotely likely. And then what happened was that in November, we got within Boris Johnson's government the appearance, if you like, of a political coup. His very powerful special advisor, Dominic Cummings, who had been the manager of the Leave campaign that had fought the Brexit referendum in 2016, and who is somebody who is committed to Brexit, he left. Apparently several of his other people left with him. When I say left, it's pretty clear that he was ousted. And that seems to have opened up more scope for, as the European Union would say, as the Remainers would say, more flexibility in the negotiations. So the deadline has approached. And remember, the law says Britain leaves the economic structures on the 31st of December. And we have negotiations continuing through November, through December. Not clear what's going on. We're not very well informed about the actual negotiations. But without Dominic Cummings, it's not clear what direction these negotiations are taking or whether there even are negotiations. Then we learn that Boris Johnson is going to fly to Brussels to talk to Ursula von Leyen, who is the president of the European Commission. They meet and have discussions for 4 hours, but apparently no breakthrough is achieved. We were then told that this past weekend, the weekend that's just passed, that would be the make or break, and that unless there was an agreement by Sunday, there could not be an agreement because there wouldn't be time for the European Parliament and for the British Parliament to agree to pass that agreement before the final deadline on the 31st of December. And we were all expecting, or we would all be told to expect, that Sunday would be the absolute last day for getting an agreement. And one of the people who, of course, led us to think that was Boris Johnson, who issued a statement on Friday saying that a no-deal Brexit now looked very, very likely. So Saturday comes and goes, and then Sunday arrives, and what do we hear? Negotiations are going to go on. They're going to go on right through the week. They're going to go on right through next week, throughout Christmas, apparently, right up to the final deadline of the 31st of December. Except, of course, that constitutionally and legally, that doesn't make any kind of sense at all. Because let's assume that an agreement of some kind is reached on the 31st of December. And the law is, the British law is unchanged. How does the British Parliament pass this deal on the 31st of December, when supposedly Britain leaves all the economic structures the following day? How does the European Parliament do it? How do all the parliaments of all the European member states do it? It is an impossible timetable. So the only logical explanation is that Johnson and Ursula von Leyen have reached some sort of agreement between them that this 31st December deadline has now become fungible and doesn't really exist at all, and that we are looking at yet another extension at the end of this year, perhaps another 6 months, another year, 2 years, three, five, who knows how long, and that the situation, in other words, will continue pretty much indefinitely, with Britain half in, half out, out of the political structures, still locked into the economic structures, no clear end point to this process. And if this all begins to sound very much like the kind of arrangement that Theresa May had negotiated and which we thought we'd left behind us, well, that is because it does.
Yeah. Brexit isn't going to happen, is it?
Well,
I mean, I'm being half serious and half.
Well,
not
I have
serious,
to say obviously. This,
but I mean, it's dragging on. What are we, five? How many?
Well,
years
absolutely.
Now?
I have to say, I thought at the time when Dominic Cummings was ousted in November, on very weird grounds. I mean, you know, that there was an argument about who should be Johnson's chief of staff, when in fact it was, to all intents and purposes, up to that point, Cummings had been Johnson's chief of staff. So that never really made any kind of sense. When Cummings was ousted, I did think, and we discussed it in a program we did for the Duran, that that meant that, you know, the whole Brexit timetable was basically in jeopardy, and that it didn't really look as if we were going to get Brexit at all. Clearly what happened was that there was some kind of a shift within the Conservative Party. Johnson's fiance, Carrie Simmons, who is supposed to be on the liberal wing of the Conservative Party, obviously had her say in what was happening, and it did look as if the whole thing was being reopened. I have to also say, when I heard that Johnson was flying to Brussels, it did make me wonder what the purpose of that trip actually was, because why would he go? Why would he be going to Brussels if he wasn't really looking for some kind of a deal? I think that the most likely prospect now is that there will be a deal, perhaps not on this week or next week, perhaps within the next few weeks after the 31st of December, but it will be on EU terms. In other words, the British will again accept a degree of regulatory control by the European Union over their domestic industries. And I think also that they may find that the European Union is prepared to make some trade-offs with the British over fisheries, which is an emotive issue for many people in Britain, and that Boris Johnson will come along and say, well, I won on fisheries. And that's the really important thing, even though in reality, the most important thing is what he's conceded, which is on state on the regulatory structure of industries and on state aid to industries, which is ultimately, for most British people, the most important thing. So that's what I think is probably happening. So we're going to end up, in effect, with an arrangement not so very different from the one that Theresa May was trying to impose on us back in 2019, and which Boris Johnson said he opposed.
Has Boris Johnson just accepted the fact that he's going to be, would be a one-term president, prime minister? Is that what you would say in the UK, a one-term prime minister, or the fact that he's just going to be changed from party leadership?
I mean, I don't think...
Has he accepted that?
Yes, I think he has. I mean, there was words that were going around back in November that he expected that he would only be prime minister for about a year, a further year, because the ouster of Cummings has weakened him politically. I have to say, ever since he fell ill in March, he seems to have lost the energy that he had previously. And the confidence and the, you know, the level of force and personality that got him through the election. And I think that the outcome of the US election has probably weakened him also. So I think that we don't have an expression like one-term prime minister. There's nothing like that. But lame duck prime minister, we certainly do. And if, as is looking increasingly likely, the 31st December deadline is somehow extended. Not clear how that will be done, but that seems to me the logic of the position now. If it's extended and he comes away with a deal, which looks very much like Theresa May's original deal, then I have to say that confidence in his leadership on the part of the Brexiteers within the Conservative Party will collapse, and we will start to see the Conservatives coming under ever greater pressure up and down the country as Nigel Farage's party is reconstituted. So I think at that point, Boris Johnson will start to look increasingly dispensable, and I think he will go. And I think at some basic level, he understands and accepts that.
Okay. I want to ask you, okay, I want you to elaborate a little on what this means for Farage, number one. Yeah. But number two, I want to ask, if nothing happens at the end of the year, then, I think it's the whole thing is just gone to hell. If the UK doesn't get out by the end of the year, then I think we all need to accept the fact that this whole thing has just fallen apart as the EU wanted. Is the UK... Is Boris, are the Conservatives, is the EU using the lockdown and the thing that we have, the COOF, let's just call it that, in order to take advantage of the situation as it is, so that they can get to this no deal. And really, the English people, really, the British people really can't do anything about it. I mean, do you understand what I mean? Everyone's kind of already, small businesses are decimated. People are locked down. People are frustrated. Yes. You know, everything's going to hell. And the EU and the UK are saying, okay, great. This is a good opportunity for us to not get a Brexit deal. And really, you know, the UK people can't do squat about it. I mean, I'm trying to get into their heads, maybe.
I think that is true, but I think even more, they sense that because of this crisis, which we've been talking about, Johnson's own political position in Britain has been weakened to the point where he was forced to dispense with the people closest to him in his government, in his own private office. People like Cummings, who were the people who were basically pushing the Brexit agenda. So they sensed a weakening at the centre, at the heart of government with Johnson. And that, of course, led them to dig in. That's how it looks to me. And you're quite right that at the moment, many people across Britain are intensely preoccupied with the intensifying economic crisis. And there is an enormous social crisis also on top of that. But it's important to stress that despite that, the Conservative parties and the Conservative government's poll ratings have held up remarkably well. The reason they've held up so well, I am sure, is because the Conservatives have been reassuring people that despite everything, they will get Brexit done. It still seems that despite all this crisis, Brexit remains the single most important issue in framing British politics. And if the Conservatives backtrack on this, then the risk they run, especially with Boris gone, or even with Boris staying, is that their poll ratings will implode, because people will say, well, they aren't handling the economy very well. They aren't handling the health crisis very well. They aren't handling Brexit at all well. So what's the point of them? And at that point, we could start to see a real crisis within the Conservative Party. But as became very obvious in 2019, there are many people within the Conservative Party who are more committed to keeping Britain in some form locked into the EU than they are in seeing the Conservative Party prosper at the opinion polls. So there are these divided loyalties there also.
Yeah. I mean, it reminds me of like these, like a type of frozen conflict that you have, like say something in Transnistria or... you know, South Ossetia, or like it literally is like a frozen conflict, which you kind of see, you know, nothing gets resolved in 1 year or in two or in three. And now you're looking at four or five, and it's just going to drag on. And the situation is just going to be what it is right now. Like I said, it's just going to be this status quo situation.
Yes.
And nothing's going to change. I mean, politically, how much could Nigel Farage really do as far as changing the situation? I mean, because you don't have the Conservatives, then you have Labour, and you have a Labour which is not with Corbyn. You have a Labour which is absolutely pro EU.
Absolutely.
I mean, what are the other options?
Yes, but the problem Labour has is that though Labour is entirely pro EU, they have lost a lot of support in their former heartlands because they are pro-EU. In order to win back that support in their former heartlands, they have to start adjusting and taking a more anti-EU position, which is what Starmer is trying to do to some extent. But that's causing major divisions within the Labour Party. And it has to be said also, it's not actually winning back support in their heartlands, because the people there in those heartlands don't believe them. And without that support of those heartlands, Labour can't win enough votes to form a government. So we have a strange situation in Britain where the Conservative vote might start to crash. Labour might not pick up support because it is very distrusted. It is seen as bitterly divided. There's now a major split within the party between the Corbynists and the Starmerists, between the left and the right. Even bigger than, you know, the comparable split within the Democrats, which is going on in the US, and where a lot of Labour's traditional support has been alienated. I have to say that it seems to me in this kind of situation, there is a big opening for Nigel Farage. He's got his Brexit party there. It's still organised. And if Farage is able to say, well, I helped the Conservatives over the line in December 2019. I didn't run candidates in Conservative seats because I realised that if I did, I would be undermining the Conservative Party at a time when Boris Johnson was promising to get Brexit done. But Boris Johnson and the Conservatives have not acted on that promise, so that there has been a betrayal, a breach of promise. Those votes in those heartland Labour seats, which are still committed to Brexit, have seen that the Conservatives don't carry out their promises. They won't get Brexit done. They've seen that Labour is incapable, functionally incapable of getting Brexit done. So vote for the only party that is really committed to Brexit and wants to see Brexit done, which is my party and me. That's about 50 seats in the north of England. Without those seats, Johnson loses his majority. Without those seats, Starmer can't gain a majority. If Farage starts to make real impacts in these seats, in fact, starts winning some of them, then the politics of Britain change again. And we will see, going down the line, precisely the kind of scenario that Matthew Paris, this Times columnist, was talking about, in which the whole issue of Brexit starts to come back and come back with a vengeance, with British politics once again becoming increasingly unstable and with a very strong pro-Brexit faction within the Conservative Party quite likely reasserting itself. But also, it must be said, under a new leader.
You've always said that the politics in the UK is very difficult, especially for parties to form and to gain traction.
Yes.
Could Farage actually pull it off? I mean, could he break this two-party system? I mean, realistically, yeah. Could he break this two-party system? If he does, I would imagine he would be a historic figure. Like we haven't seen in a long, long time. If he's actually able to break the stranglehold that Labour and the Conservatives have,
well, bear something in mind. To a great extent, he already has. I mean, he achieved something completely unique in British politics, which is coming from completely outside the political system. When he formed UKIP, even though he didn't win that many seats, he absolutely scared the Conservatives to the point that David Cameron was forced to call the Brexit referendum. That wouldn't have happened unless the Conservatives felt that, you know, the hot breath of Farage on their heel, at their back. So that's an important thing to say about Farage. He didn't achieve the parliamentary breakthrough, largely because the Conservatives rushed to give him what he demanded, which was the Brexit referendum. So it's not impossible that all this could reproduce itself, but with the bitter anger of betrayal thrown in on top, in which case it's not impossible that there could be an electoral breakthrough by Farage in all these seats. Can I just say, they look extremely difficult to me for Labour to win back, certainly with the kind of leadership that Labour has at the moment. Keir Starmer is a Southern English Remainer. He's got a knighthood. He's very much part of the Labour establishment. He's an MP, a North London MP. He's a famous pro-Remainer. Very difficult person to see him winning these seats back. The Conservatives, when they won those seats in December 2019, they didn't actually win them because these are natural Conservative seats. They were, if you like, loaned to them because they promised to get Brexit done. If neither a Starmer-led Labour Party can win those seats, or a Conservative Party led by Boris or someone like him can win those seats, then it seems to me that a way is open for someone like Farage to do it instead, given that it's also the case that Farage, despite being in no sense working class himself, does have traction with working class voters in a way that it seems no one else in Britain at the moment does.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sorry. I mean, you know, Farage gave them every single chance to retain power with the condition that you make Brexit happen. I think Farage has definitely lived up to his end of the bargain. And there's no other way to describe it as he's been completely betrayed and backstabbed. We are, I saw on the live stream, I didn't see who it was, but someone said, weren't we talking about this the same time last year? That is such a good point. That is such an astute point. This has gotten to the point of comical. It really has gotten to the point of comical. And this is exactly from the EU's playbook. The EU does this all the time. When they don't get the result they want, they delay and they delay and they grind you down and they grind the population down.
Yes.
And then they throw this pandemic in there and they throw this economic hardship in there and they grind you down even more. And at the end of the day, they end up getting what they want, the political elite in Brussels. And this is exactly where they're taking the UK. They're taking the UK exactly down this road.
I think the essential point to understand is that the British political class never wanted Brexit at all. That this is something that is being forced on them, which they never wanted. And they have done everything they possibly can to stop it happening. I mean, they had all those ideas, if you remember, for a long time about having a second referendum, which is basically not really a second referendum at all. As I always used to say, it was really an attempt to hold the first referendum all over again. They wanted to redo the whole thing from the beginning, reverse it, go back into the EU. And then when they realized they couldn't do that, they wanted a Brexit, which wasn't really. And this is Matthew Paris now I'm referring to, who's a Remainer, not really a Brexit either. A Brexit, which would be a political Brexit, but not an economic one, not even a legal one. Because if you're still under the regulatory control of the EU, that's not a legal Brexit. So in effect, they wanted a Brexit, which was ultimately no Brexit at all, so that they would be able to say in 10 years' time, well, look, since we're still under the EU's regulatory structure, we might as well rejoin. And that's been the problem. You have the situation where the political class in London simply doesn't want a Brexit, which is what a majority of the British people in 2016 voted for, what they voted for again in the general election last year, and what the Conservative government was elected to do. And this is what has undermined them, because if you're negotiating with an entity like the EU, you need to be completely clear about what you are intent on achieving. You need to be absolutely solid on your position. When Dominic Cummings was chief of staff, was Boris Johnson's chief of staff, well, some of that solidity was there. But without that solidity, without that unity of purpose, that singleness of purpose at the heart of government, you go into a negotiation with the EU, and you're never going to get what you wanted. They will always impose their views upon you. My father once put it to me like this, because remember he had many dealings for Greece, for the Greek government, with the EU. He said to me, "It's like putting your money negotiating with the EU." This is long before Tsipras came along. This is in the good days, if you like. It's like negotiating, like dealing with a defective slot machine. You put your money in all the time, but nothing comes out. Nothing comes out until eventually you've put all your money in and they just give you a tiny little piece of paper which doesn't mean anything. And that's what negotiating with the EU is like.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Boris had his window of opportunity when Trump was at his strongest. I think that's when the UK was at its strongest as far as leverage, because Trump was hammering away at Germany. He was hammering away at the EU. He was putting a lot of demands on NATO and on Europe, and demands on Germany as well with Merkel. He never liked Merkel. There was no secret there that Trump and Merkel did not get along. Trump made overtures to Boris and the UK that, you know, they would step up and, you know, sign a trade agreement right there. And then he said it would be a tough negotiation. As Trump always says, I'm sure he loves to negotiate. He's the great negotiator. But he said, you know, we would be open to welcome a deal with the UK. Mm-hmm. Boris had such a great window of opportunity.
He did
pull the trigger on this thing, and he completely messed it up. He delayed and he delayed. And when you delay these things, you know, expect the unexpected. As has happened in 2020, the unexpected happened. And now it looks like he's on his back heel. And I just get the impression, Alexander, that, God, and I hate to say it to the globalists, they seem to be gaining strength. That's my impression. They seem to be closing rank. Oh, yeah. They're gaining strength, and neoliberals seem to be gaining strength. And Boris doesn't.
I think that's absolutely right. They are gaining strength. But if we go up to Boris, let's just deal with Boris first. He became prime minister. He won the election, and then he relaxed. I can remember this extraordinary period in January and February. Well, he was going on leave most of the time. He was going to, you know, he was going on holiday to various places, and then he during the summer he was going, even as the health crisis was exploding, he was going on leave too. I mean, he is not, I think, very much of a hands-on person, and with the EU, you need to be. Obviously, you need a clear head. You mustn't get yourself bogged down in the detail in the way that Theresa May did. But you need to have some grip on what is happening.
Or a sense of urgency.
A sense of urgency, exactly. Now, I get the sense that Cummings, and, you know, I don't want to be too favourable to Cummings. Cummings was a very flawed man, and he took credit for a lot of things that other people did. And to put it straightforwardly, I mean, he was never Mr. Brexit. If anybody was, that was Farage, not Cummings. But at least Cummings had focus. He had focus. And Boris never did. And Boris depended too much on Cummings to have that focus for him. And when Cummings was ousted, by that point, the opportunity was slipping away. I agree, by the way. I think what Boris needed to do when he won the election, not give himself a whole year. He needed to give himself 6 months at most and say, look, we have a deal. These are our terms. This is what you should have said to the EU. These are our terms. We're not prepared to pull back from them. These are our red lines. Either you accept them or not. And that's it. It's the only way to negotiate with the EU. Otherwise, negotiating with the EU, another metaphor I've heard somebody else give me, is that it's like having all your teeth extracted one by one. without any anesthetic. So at the end, you get an awful lot of pain and you're left without teeth.
Alexander, can we talk about how Wales sees this, how Scotland sees this? Mm. What about Ireland and Northern Ireland? I mean, that was one of the big stories was the backstop and how to deal with that. I mean, the more this gets delayed, all of this just kind of becomes irrelevant, doesn't it?
It does become irrelevant. Now, I mean, the first thing to say is Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland are all pro-Remain. I mean, they always have been. They are very much the pro-Remain areas of Britain, as well as London, by the way. And they all voted heavily for Remain. And one of the things that has, I think, spooked some people in London is that there have been heavy hints in Scotland that unless Britain remains in the EU in some form, Scotland might actually go ahead and start taking the first steps towards secession by calling an independence referendum. Boris has said he opposes that, by the way, and will not consent to such a referendum being held. My own personal view, for what it's worth, is that both with Ireland and with Scotland, perhaps not with Wales. Wales, by the way, is more divided. There's a lot of pro-leave sentiment in Wales.
Yeah, I'm saying that in the live stream. People are saying that Wales did vote heavily leave.
Leave, exactly. Wales is different. And I mean, you know, the working class regions of Wales, it's completely different politics there. But Scotland, I think they were worried that it might secede. My own personal view is that that is wrong. I think on the contrary, British membership of the EU has actually strengthened secessionist trends in Scotland, because Scottish politicians say, we don't need England anymore because we're able to deal directly with Brussels. So we don't need to go through London in order to deal with Brussels. If Britain leaves the EU, Scotland is so economically integrated with England as part of the United Kingdom that I have to say, I think over time, may take a while for this to work itself way out, but I think over time, there will be more and more people in Scotland within the business community, within the unions and those sorts of people who will start to say, well, maybe we have our, you know, old rivalries with the English, but we have to have some kind of representation in London, which is, after all, part of the country that we were part of for so long, because we need to have that representation in London in order to look after our interests and ourselves. So at that point, the centrifugal forces which have been pulling Scotland away whilst Britain remained in the EU will reverse themselves, and you'll start to see forces pulling Scotland back towards England. That's what I think. Bear in mind that Scottish independence was very much a fringe issue until Britain joined the EU. It has grown in scale at an exponential rate only after Britain joined the EU, because whilst Britain was part of the European single market, the Scots could say to themselves, well, we can leave Britain. We can have a Scottish nationalist government in Scotland, because ultimately, economically speaking, severing the political links with London won't matter, because economically, we're all part of the same thing. So I think, actually, if you take a unionist view, then pushing for a no-deal Brexit actually works better for you in the long term. You have to ride out the turbulence that there would be for about, you know, a couple of years, maybe. But at the end of it, you'd actually get a stronger United Kingdom than the one you have now.
And Ireland, is that an issue anymore?
Ireland, I think.
With all these delays?
Ireland, I think, is a different story. Now, you see, this is the other thing, because, again, Boris has completely reversed position, because at one point he was saying, well, you know, the withdrawal agreement, it created this barrier between Northern Ireland and the rest of the of Great Britain. And this was something that, you know, we're not prepared to tolerate if we go for a no-deal Brexit. So we're going to break that link, that barrier, and we're going to proceed. We're going to unilaterally change the withdrawal agreement, and we're going to reintegrate Northern Ireland back in the into the UK. Then he reversed course, and over the last few months, it's another sign, by the way, that he's basically slipping on his no-deal agenda. He basically accepted that, you know, Northern Ireland would remain integrated to some extent, to a great extent, within the European single market, as it still is now. My own view about this, I went to Ireland last year. I've spoken with many Irish people now on both sides of the political divide, is that it is only a question of time before Ireland leaves the United Kingdom and unites with the South, with the Irish Republic in the South. So I personally think that comparisons between Ireland and Scotland, they're completely different. And I think that the most logical thing to do for the British is to say to themselves, well, Northern Ireland is going its own way anyway. We've never really felt that same connection to Northern Ireland that we do to Scotland. So let's accept, as part of a no-deal situation, that Northern Ireland is going to go its own way, and prepare ourselves for that reality and go ahead and make the clean break with the EU, which is what we want and what ultimately will bind Scotland and Wales more closely back to with England again into the United Kingdom of Great Britain, binding together those parts of Great Britain that not only want to stay together, but which it is in their interests to stay together. So I think Northern Ireland should be looked at differently from Scotland. And as our viewers have absolutely rightly said, Wales is different again because it voted leave.
Right. But I mean, that's, you know, dealing with the issue in Ireland, that's not a short-term issue. You're looking maybe 5-10 years.
Absolutely.
Down the line. I mean, it's Boris needs to handle Brexit now. Ireland is something that's going to take time.
Exactly. Well, I mean, probably longer than 5 or 10 years. But, you know, however long it is, I completely agree. The point I'm making is I don't think he should worry about Northern Ireland, because the trajectory is towards Irish Union anyway. So, you know, whatever he does, it's not going to change the direction of travel there. With Scotland, it's different. But I think if whoever is prime minister, if it's not Boris, provided they've got strong nerves and are prepared to see this thing through, then I think they can probably, if they can ride out the turbulence of the next few years, they will see that Scotland starts to drift back.
Okay, well, I definitely think that Boris is starting to crack. And that's
I agree. I mean, because again, that's the other problem, is that it's not obvious if he goes, who takes over from him. It's a very weak cabinet. Very few of the people in it look to be particularly capable and particularly strong. The second man in the cabinet is nominally a man called Dominic Raab, who is the foreign secretary. I don't think anybody thinks that he's a convincing future prime minister. The other person that you sometimes hear people talk about is a person called Michael Gove, who's currently the cabinet office minister. He's very ambitious, extremely clever, widely mistrusted within the Conservative Party, was the chairman of the Leave campaign in the 2016 Brexit referendum. But there's always been the view that he would be more than happy to accept a softer Brexit even than Boris's. So it's very difficult to see if Boris goes that whoever takes over from him is going to be as hardline or more hardline than he appeared to be, because the just don't seem to be those sort of people in the Conservative Party at its top leadership at present. And I mean, people talk a lot about Rees-Mogg, but I don't think that he is anywhere close to being elected Conservative leader for the moment.
What about the his name that was being chosen to succeed Boris, that the media was going crazy over?
Well, absolutely. Sunak, the Chancellor.
Yes,
absolutely.
Sunak.
Yes. Well, the universal expectation. By the way, I think if Boris goes within a year, Sunak looks very much to me like the favourite. I mean, I would have thought he would almost certainly be the person to take over. Nobody really knows very much about him, but my own sense is that he would be even softer in pursuing a Brexit than, say, Michael Gove is. So, a Rishi Sunak government, I think, would be more than happy to accommodate the EU on these sort of issues.
Okay. He reminds me, he's like the, I saw someone saying the Kamala Harris of the UK, someone in the last year. But he reminds me a lot of Obama,
absolutely,
the charismatic guy, but no one really knows much about him.
Absolutely.
He's a charismatic figure that the media is just, drooling over.
Drooling over, exactly. And I have to say, I have as much as many doubts about him as I did about Obama back in 2008. And I think that those doubts, if he ever becomes prime minister, would be confirmed. I don't think he's remotely the person, the man for the moment in any conceivable way. But as I said, we do have a dearth of strong leaders in Britain. And it's not clear to me who would come along and step in and see this thing done in that kind of way. It all seemed to depend an awful lot on Boris Johnson. And with him cracking and, not the man he was a year ago, I have to say, the prospects, at least in the short term, don't look very good.
Yeah, I agree with you there. Things do not look good. These delays don't look good at all for Brexit at all.
Absolutely. Now, I mean, there's always a possibility that things could turn out otherwise. And I think we have to be also say that too. I mean, there is concern within sections of the Conservative Party about the fact that if they do start to backtrack, there could be a political crisis in the long term for the Conservative Party, that it will start to lose these 54 seats that it won in the 2019 election, that all these places like Bishop Auckland and others, Lee and all those places in the north of England, which were formerly Labour seats and very strong Labour seats with very strong working class traditions, which aren't natural Conservative territory, that they might start to peel away because they will say, well, the Conservatives didn't keep their promises. So there are people within the Conservative Party who speak out like that. But whether they would prevail in this situation, I don't know. And I'm getting the sense that Johnson has been greatly weakened. He's lost the people within his own office who were, with Dominic Cummings, who were keeping him focused on getting Brexit done and were explaining to him the importance of getting Brexit done. And as a result, the Remain establishment in the Conservative Party, which has never gone away, is in the ascendant again.
Okay, let's do some super chats. Got some questions. Val, yes, once again, thank you for the super chat from Sparky. Rebainers bank on fear Biden won't trade with the UK.
Well, that's absolutely true. Again, I have to say, I personally don't take that seriously. But of course, the point is, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you say to yourself all the time, well, Biden's going to come along, and you know, if Biden comes along, he won't take us seriously. Then of course he won't take you seriously. Why should he? If you are a strong, assertive country under a strong, assertive leader, a Margaret Thatcher, then of course people take you seriously. But if you're a weak country which doesn't know its own mind, then people won't.
Okay, from Sparky, if Trump doesn't prevail, he should push a replacement party, not third party. Who cares which party it replaces? It would go against the Uniparty.
Well, I think that in Britain, Farage has created a powerful third party. I mean, bear in mind, in the European elections, which took place in May last year, Farage won. He actually came top. He actually won those elections, which is pretty remarkable, actually, for a third party to do.
Okay, from Mark Hewitt, if there is no deal and the Gasly WA comes into force.
Yes.
It seems that the plan is that Boris will say to the country, my last minute deal or the WA.
Well, this is the sort of things that you hear about all the time. I mean, the important thing to understand about a no-deal situation is that, yes, there would be some problems, there would be some turbulence at the beginning, but 90% of the British economy trades with itself or trades with other countries outside the EU. It would not be an existential disaster for Britain in the way that some people say it is. Britain has its own currency. It has its own central bank, very powerful central bank. British currency is the oldest currency in the world. It goes all the way back to the 5th century AD. It's got a very long, continuous history. Britain can ride out a few months of turbulence. And during that time, there would be pressure on the EU as well. There would be German car manufacturers who would have lost an important market. There would be French fishermen and people like that who would be excluded from British waters. There would be problems for the EU also. So at that point, once the British had shown that they are serious about leaving and had overcome that turbulence, as they would, the terms of trade, if you like, the balance of power in the negotiation would shift, and it would shift in Britain's favour. At least that is absolutely my view. And then you could negotiate seriously about, you know, a sensible free trade deal of the sort that many countries around the world have with the EU. Canada has one, Australia has one, many countries do. But it would not be one that is so completely lopsided in the EU's favour as the proposals that the EU has been making now.
Okay, from Darren Alevi, what's the betting? We have another delay in meeting rearranged Hotel California. You can supposedly check out, e.g. vote to get out, but never leave.
So many people are talking about Hotel California. It's been, I should say, it's almost a reporter's cliche, at least a lever reporter's cliche here. And one almost gets the sense of that. I mean, that the EU has almost become a Hotel California. I have to say, I mean, it's not yet happened, and maybe it won't happen, but all the indications are that we will get another extension at the end of this year, or we will get a deal on EU terms, which is rushed through the British Parliament and perhaps the EU Parliament and EU Member States Parliaments within a couple of days, which will also be on the EU's terms. So, I mean, that it seems to me is the likeliest scenario. Either a further extension with more and more negotiations going on indefinitely, or a deal very much stacked in the EU's favour. a no-deal Brexit is still a possibility, but the prospects of it are receding.
Okay, from Mark Hewitt, if Bojo betrays us on Brexit, never mind the end of the Conservative Party, it will be civil war.
Well, I don't think it will be civil war, but it will be a major political crisis in Britain, because an awful lot of people across Britain will feel very, very angry, and they will never trust the Conservatives again. They're very alienated already from Labour. They were prepared to vote Conservative to get Brexit done. They will say, and this is something you often hear people talk about in Britain, same old Tories, same old Conservative Party. You can't trust them.
Keep it up from Martin, a super sticker. Thank you very much, Martin. From Moon Swan Silverlight. Did you know that Doris the Jellyfish's hero is actually Neville Chamberlain and not Churchill?
Well, indeed. I mean, that's that. I have to say, I've never liked this parallel between Boris and Churchill. Boris has certain rhetorical gifts, and he's far from being a stupid man. But Churchill was a lot more than just rhetorical gifts. He was also, by the way, a brilliant manager. And he was somebody who was absolutely always and at all times in control. I mean, he knew what he was doing. I mean, you're dealing with a tremendous figure in British history, Winston Churchill. Not by any means, by the way, a figure without flaws. There's lots of things about Churchill you can criticize. But, you know, somebody who is a colossus. And Boris, I'm afraid, he's not Winston Churchill, never has been. Is he a Chamberlain? Well, he hasn't been that yet, but I'm afraid it's increasingly looking as if he might be.
All right, from Sparky, significant third party is impossible in the US without ranked choice voting. Just as Republicans replaced Whigs, yeah, Republican Party can also be replaced.
Well, I think that may be true. I mean, I've heard lots of things about how problematic it is in the United States. I think it's easier in Britain, actually, because if a third party starts to assert itself, bear in mind that it would be a Brexit party winning seats would be winning votes from both Labour and Conservative. That's an important point to understand. And it would have a more focused programme than other third parties that have risen, or at least been created, and then have then failed in Britain, like, you know, the Social Democratic Party that was launched in the 1980s, because its purpose would be to achieve a specific outcome, which is Britain's severance from the EU. So people of different views could vote for it in order to achieve that outcome. It would be more like, in some ways, the Scottish Nationalist Party, which won 40 seats in the 2015 election, again, in order, supposedly, to win a specific outcome, which was Scottish independence. So I think that a Brexit party would have much more scope for achieving that kind of electoral breakthrough in Britain. And then, of course, if it did, the whole politics of Britain changes forever. It would never be the same again.
Okay, from Mark Hewitt, could the ERG leave the Tory party?
Well, it's possible. I think that some people within the ERG, if they decide that there is no possibility, I should say, the ERG, for those of our viewers who are not British, is the European Research Group. That's a strange name. But what it is basically the hardline Brexiters within the Conservative Party, within the Conservative Parliamentary Party, and they're led by Rees-Mogg. Rees-Mogg has been their chief, if you will. Some of them are very, very committed Brexiters. I think they're more committed to Brexit than they are to the Conservative Party itself, and I think some of them might leave the Conservative Party if they saw that there was no way that a Conservative Party would see Brexit done, as it has promised to do, and that the only way to do it would be to line up with Nigel Farage. I would say that Farage's own relationship with the ERG has not always been a very easy one. So it would be interesting to see how that works out. But I can see some of them doing it. Yes.
All right. From Silent Gary, what will it take for the people in Europe to start a French Revolution style? Beheading the elite.
Well, I think in Britain, we are a rather more, shall we say, restrained people. France, where they've had those traditions, it's a different matter. I mean, I was watching a very interesting French film from the 1920s made by a man called Abel Gance, which is about the French Revolution and the rise of Napoleon. And it was certainly dramatic stuff. I could just about see something like that happening in France. Can't imagine it happening in Britain at the moment. So no, I don't see that sort of revolution in Britain. I think much more likely you would see a Brexit party formed, sweeping across England, winning seats from Labour and Conservative. Remember, even to this day, more Labour MPs represent seats which voted Leave than represent seats which voted Remain in the Brexit referendum. That's always an important thing to understand. So I can easily see that happening and basically shocking the entire political system into pushing further towards a proper Leave.
All right, from Darren Alevi, Britain is in need of a new political parties, both on the left and the right. The Conservatives are using Brexit as a carrot, never committing to the final step, but dangle it for votes.
I think so many people in Britain, in England especially, will think that if a no-deal Brexit doesn't happen on the 31st of December. So many people, same old Tories, that's a popular cry in Britain. It's one you hear many times. I've heard it many times in the past. It would come back with a vengeance if things turn out in the way we've just been talking about.
All right. And the final super chat is from Interim President Toilet Sauce. Why does Britain like tea so much? Because tea leaves.
Ah, well, that's so good. Actually, I've got tea in my Duran Magic mug. This has got the flag of Greece, as you can see, but just to make absolutely clear where my allegiances are in this program, here you see me with my Duran hat with the Union Jack there. So tea leaves, exactly.
All right, we will leave it there on that note. And with that note, we will also leave. All right, guys, let's end this this live stream. Good. Oh, wait, we got one more. Do you think from Spartacle 1954, this will be the last super chat, and we'll end this stream. Do you think with Norway's stance on the situation is a lever for causing themselves justification for their own disassociating with the EU?
Yes, I do. I think Norway is taking a very interesting stance, and look at the pattern there. When Norway voted against joining the EU, it was because a party very similar to the Brexit Party emerged in Norway to campaign against Norway joining the EU. And then we had a negotiation, a renegotiation. That party then went into sort of hibernation. The old political parties reasserted themselves in Norway. We now have the renegotiation of the relationship. And what's happened is that because of that renegotiation, that same party, which in Norway campaigned all those years ago to keep Norway out of the EU, has reformed and reasserted itself and is now once again leading in the opinion polls. And the result is that the Norwegian government, which consists of the old established parties, has been obliged to harden its line. And that's exactly what I predict is going to eventually happen in Britain. We don't get a no-deal clean break Brexit at the end of this year. You will see a Brexit party, which is already there, gaining traction all over Britain again, led undoubtedly initially by Nigel Farage, but becoming increasingly a permanent fixture of British politics.
All right, we'll end it there. Thanks, guys, for a really, really good live stream talking about Brexit. And we'll be back again live probably on Friday. I imagine we'll have more videos out tomorrow. And take care, everybody. Have a great day. Thank you for those super chats. Thank you for the questions. Thank you for supporting our channel. We really appreciate it. Go to the Durant Shop, pick up some merch, help out this channel. Please share this video and hit that like. Before you exit, hit that like if you haven't hit that like. Take care, everybody. Have a great morning, afternoon, or evening. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.